Back in 1965, on a day so hot that God Almighty should have been writhing with sick to the stomach guilt over driving his children out of the cool green of Eden, my daddy walked into our general store, held a revolver to his head, told my mama that he couldn't take any more, and that because of her harsh ways and his many sins, he was gonna blow his brains out.
New fiction from writers Connie Mae Fowler and Jane Mendelson, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's weekly radio magazine about books and ideas. Connie Mae Fowler and Jane Mendelson are here to read from and talk about their new novels, Before Women Had Wings and I Was Amelia Earhart. These days, writer Connie Mae Fowler lives about an hour from Tallahassee in a setting that she calls subtle, quiet, and beautiful. But life for the 38-year-old novelist wasn't always so serene. In her new book, Connie Mae Fowler looks back upon her own past to write about families and children corrupted by the pressures of violence and alcoholism. But because the book resists the stereotypes of social pathology, it's not just another victim narrative. Set in the mid-1960s, Before Women Had Wings tells the story of 6-year-old Abigail Avocet Jackson, her father, mother, sister, and brother, along with a remarkable and mysterious black woman named Miss Zara. Connie Mae Fowler talks about her new book in just a moment, but first we begin with a reading from Before Women Had Wings.
I traveled such a far distance that night, from suffering the brunt of Mama's unbridled rage and receiving the worst beating of my life, to stumbling upon that cemetery of fallen stars at Diamond Lil's, to the strange joy of meeting Big Al, to the thrill of riding on his Harley and the awe-inspiring sight of my Avocets, to the comforting and idle chatter of us three souls, Miss Zora, Phoebe, and me, lying on the living room floor, trying to find comfort in a world bent on spinning out of control. And so it was time to sleep. Miss Zora talked us into Sandman Land. She told us about fishing for her and her family supper down there in Ochopee. Mullets, reds, grouper, we ate like royalty back then, she said. As she spoke, I listened beyond her words, trying to detect the sound of the Plymouth turning off Nebraska Avenue, and then Mama traveling under the oaks to her parking place in front of the trailer. I thought about Big Al and his poetry, and how he looked when the night swallowed him up. He looked eternal, as if that Harley and those stars and the fat moon rising above the mossy branches were a part of my life forever. I rested my hand in Miss Zora's and made a giant wish. Maybe Big Al would bring Mama home. And just because she'd met a good man who carried her to her children and who lifted a corner of this jagged world off her shoulders, she would change. In the evening's first dream, I saw her and Big Al sitting in an all-night diner, drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, talking, sweetly, gently, sweetly.
Blackbirds singing in the dead of night, take these sunken eyes and learn to see.
Connie, it is a pleasure to welcome you to the National Humanities Center. Congratulations on Before Women Had Wings.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell our listeners what happens in 1965. The Jackson family, Billy and...
It's Billy and Glory Marie and mm-hmm. their two girls. Mm-hmm. There is a son who is a half-brother to the girls. He's off in college. And 1965, the summer, is a hot, harsh summer. And Billy Jackson is a man who's haunted by his past and the fact that his dreams have not been met. And so on a hot afternoon, he walks into their general store and holds a revolver to his head in front of the children and says he's going to go to the river and kill himself.
Now, you put all of this, the burden of much of this, you put onto the shoulders of a little girl whose name is Avocet Abigail Jackson. Great name.
Thank you.
Nickname is Bird. Tell us about this little person and how all of this emotional baggage ends up on her shoulders, much of it, that is, and how she retells the story.
Well, Bird sees the world through both wondrous and sort of fundamental eyes. Mm-hmm. She interprets things the best way she possibly can. And so her interpretation of reality is different than what an adult's interpretation of reality would be. But she's honest as the day is long, and she soaks up the world around her and tries to report it as honestly mm-hmm. as she can.
Is this you, Connie?
Yes.
How much of this is you?
This book is very, very close to my own upbringing. And the writing of it was amazing because to delve into this little girl named Bird taught me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that taught me was that she was a really decent kid, and she didn't deserve a lot of the things that she went through.
Right. What happens to Glory Marie and her two girls and Hank after Billy is out of the picture?
Well, it's very ironic because even though he was the person who really was the source of much of the mother's pain, once he was gone, she felt anchorless. And her temper grew even worse, and her drinking grew worse, and the alcohol fueled that anger.
Mm-hmm.
And so they move out of the Grove to Tampa, and they live at the Traveler's Motel in a broken down travel trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And things just get worse.
Now, there really is such a place, am I right?
There really is such a place.
Uh-huh. With a swimming pool that's kind of seedy. And
yeah, and I really lived there.
Right.
And I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I knew we had a different life, and I didn't like the giant spiders and the cockroaches and all of that that goes along with living in such a place.
Right.
But for all the time, there were just amazing people going through there, and it did have that pool. So for our little girl, that was wonderful.
Tell us, Connie, about Miss Zora. This is one of the sort of redemptive elements in your book. Who is she? What does she do in this book?
Miss Zora is a woman who is a sort of salt-of-the-earth figure who has wonderfully liberal politics, who believes that there are earth cures, and she knows what weeds and wildflowers grow in the field that will cure what. And she is Bird's first and only encounter with that notion of unconditional love.
Uh-huh.
And Bird really, really needs to meet her when she does.
Is she a witch in the best sense of the word?
I think so, because she is connected to earth cures and earth powers.
Mm-hmm.
And a very gentle spirit who also has her own tragic past to deal with.
She's modeled, as I understand it, on Zora Neale Hurston. I mean, you take the name straight from the flesh and blood human being. Here we're getting into the sort of literary antecedents of your book. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, in each one of my books, I have a character who owes something to Zora Neale Hurston. And I think that Miss Zora, of course, is the most obvious one. I think as a writer who was born and raised in Florida, that I owe a huge debt to Zora Neale Hurston. If she had not done what she did, going up and down the coast and as a WPA project, gathering the folklore, all that would be lost. Florida mm-hmm. is a state that just discards its history like it was disposable toilet paper or something. And so without her, we would have had a huge cultural abyss there. So I always work her research into my own work.
What about the landscape? It is a cliche in our culture that you Southern writers, I suppose you think of yourself as a Southern writer, draw on the earth, the land, a sense of place. How does that work in this book?
In this book, I've taken a turn because in my previous two books, the landscape was always healing. Always. And that was the source of power for people and the source of healing. In this book, I'm playing with Old Testament versus New Testament myth of the earth.
Hmm.
And so in the beginning of the book, they find themselves in this orange grove, and much of the mythology that I'm dealing with is sort of a wrathful God where the earth turns against you.
Mm-hmm.
But then Bird meets Mizora, and she realizes that there's a redemptive power out there and that the earth can be healing.
Well, they travel on, what is it called, the Prince of Peace Citrus Highway?
That's right.
Is there such a thing?
No, I made that up, but it's pretty close to what some of these roads out there are called.
So we've got the Eden myth at work here.
That's
and,
right.
And little Bird, is she Eve? Is she coming to terms with not only being a person, but a female person, and learning to live with the difficulties of her family?
Right. And she's also, more than anything, she's the traveler. She's traveling through the stories. I'm traveling through observing her parents' life. I'm trying to make sense of whether God is a wrathful or a kind God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she gives up on Jesus. Tell us quickly about this. This is a kind of episodic thing that runs through your book. She wants Jesus for a boyfriend.
Right.
And then what happens?
Well, her life just keeps getting more and more harsh. And so after a while, she just decides that she's been jilted by Jesus, that he's no longer her boyfriend. And she's got to find a new way to go.
Well, she has men in her life who treat her poorly. She also has men in her life who treat her pretty well. Tell us about Big Al.
Big Al he's a biker. He's a Walt Whitman aficionado.
Uh-huh.
And she meets him after a particularly severe beating. And he puts her on the back of the bike and takes her out to the water where for the first time she sees the avocets, which are the birds that she's named for. And he explains to her that she's not at fault. She didn't deserve the beatings.
You really are having fun here. I mean, you're unpacking a lot of stereotypes and you're reversing them. I mean, here you've got somebody from very much a Hell's Angel character who is basically a guardian angel,
mm-hmm.
like Miss Zora.
That's right.
Now, are you poking fun at religion here when you upset these stereotypical ways that we think about God and the devil and good and evil? What's at work?
Well, I think that I'm trying to upset the apple cart of fundamental religion. And I'm always been fascinated with the way religion works in our lives, both superstition and religion. And as we get more and more in a just technologically driven society,
right,
how does God fit into that world?
Uh-huh.
And so all of my characters are always wrestling with that, but I think Bird wrestles with it most directly.
Well, now, let me argue with you for a moment, Connie. If you say you're trying to upset the sort of fundamentalist take on religion, nonetheless, little Bird herself and the characters in this book are immersed in
That's
a world
right.
of spirits and belief, and precisely that environment that we associate with fundamentalist religion.
That's right.
Let's
and they have to decide whether they continue to take it fundamentally,
mm-hmm.
or they're going to see religion and spirituality in more dynamic terms. Mm-hmm. Mizora sees it in very, very dynamic terms and magical terms, whereas what Bird begins to learn at first is just all very, very fundamental,
right.
and it becomes destructive to her.
Let's talk about the writer's work, so to speak, the artistry, the aesthetic dimension that's at work in this book, Before Women Had Wings. You are very skillfully handle the imagery of birds and the analogy to human lives. Tell us about how you put those images together, what inspired them, and how they play throughout this novel.
Well, I think that the bird imagery, by and large, acts as symbols for transformation and escape. A lot of the bird imagery came subconsciously. And I think that a lot of writers work, most of the writing takes place when they're not actually thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so
bad necessarily,
no,
is it?
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a very organic process.
Uh-huh.
And then I would read through and not always be aware of the amount of bird imagery that was in the book, or it would surprise me suddenly that it worked itself in once again.
Uh-huh.
Some of it was by design, but a lot of it was by instinct.
How does Little Bird herself end up in the imagery of birds as it works here in your book? Is she finally free? I mean, this is, after all, a country that is in love with happy endings. You want to fill us in there?
Well, you know, I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. I mean, I think the ending is for each individual's interpretation, and some people will decide that the mother is healed and that Bird flies. She flies to an extent. My opinion of it changes daily. I think that they had a really hard row to hoe, the mother particularly. But Bird, if anybody's going to survive, it would be a little girl like Bird.
Connie Mae Fowler is the author of Before Women Had Wings, a novel published by Putnam. Last summer, Before Women Had Wings was awarded the Southern Book Critics Award for Fiction, and film rights have been sold to Oprah Winfrey. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Straight ahead, more about women in flight. Writer Jane Mendelsohn is here to read from and talk about her new novel, I Was Amelia Earhart.
This is the story of what happened to me when I died. It's also the story of my life. Destiny, the alchemy of fate and luck. I think about it sometimes under a radiant sun. Today, when I think of my former life, I think of it as a dream. In the dream, I am another person. In the dream, I am the most famous aviatrix of my day, a heroine. I'm Amelia Earhart.
Jane Mendelsohn's new novel is I Was Amelia Earhart. In prose at once lyrical, imaginative, and sensuous, the book is a meditation on the last days of America's most famous aviatrix. In 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, left Miami in hopes of making the first flight around the equator. But on the last leg of their journey, as Jane Mendelsohn puts it in her book, these two lost souls in an immense netherworld disappeared in the South Pacific. It's here that the historical record leaves off, and Jane Mendelsohn's novel begins. With an excerpt from I Was Amelia Earhart, here is Jane Mendelsohn.
As they descend, she can feel the full weight of her ship barreling beneath her. It is a soaring, howling fall. She comes reeling out of the sky like some wanton satellite, winging her way reckless and unhinged. Her metal skeleton scrapes the atmosphere, which seems to rupture as she passes, healing behind her as she passes, sucking her through again and again. She feels the shaking of her brakes and the shivering of her wings in a sweeping passage down to where she lingers for a moment in the moonlit darkness, the sea below her as black as blood. For a moment, everything sway. The silent waves, the hot, salt air, the wind holding her up before letting her go. Then a cracking and a breaking and a last long shudder as she speeds down into the final chaos. He grabbed onto her, sobbing, when he felt the fall. He clutched her hair and he gasped for breath. She carried the weight of him in her arms, letting the tears roll down her neck, and she thought about the weakness of men. She felt weak herself, but not too frightened to face the night and everything it offered, even if what it offered was only death. They were both dying ridiculous deaths, she thought, brought about by hubris and liquor. She was filled with regret for not having been kinder to him, and she burned with a desire to start their journey over from the beginning. But she couldn't forgive him for everything he'd done, and she blamed him more than herself for her circumstances. She wished she could say something comforting to him, but she couldn't. And then she wished that he would pull himself together. She looked over his shoulder out the window at the night, and she saw the strange constellations, empty and meaningful, strung like jewels. She wanted to live, but it occurred to her that death might be just as beautiful as flying. "I'm sorry," he said finally. "This was all my fault." "Don't be an idiot," she said.
Jane, welcome to the National Humanities Center. Congratulations on this wonderful book.
Oh, thanks.
Tell us about the real Amelia Earhart and what you have done with the end of this famous person's life.
Well, the real Amelia Earhart was the most famous aviatrix of her time, and she attempted a round-the-world flight. It ended up being her last flight. It was probably planned to be her last flight anyway. It was in 1937, and she was 39. And she went off with a navigator. And it was not the most carefully planned flight, this we know. And we know that during the course of the trip, she sent back a few messages saying she was having personnel problems, which that's been interpreted to mean that her navigator was drinking. He had a reputation as a drinker. They made it almost all the way around, but They were trying to find the last leg. They were leaving from New Guinea, trying to find a small island in the Pacific called Howland Island. Mm-hmm. And they didn't make it. And that's where what we know about her, for sure, mm-hmm. ends.
That's the beginning point for you, so
yes.
to speak.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Well, apart from the trappings of the plot, these two people mm-hmm. stranded on this tiny little dot of land out there mm-hmm. in the Pacific, you've been accused of writing a sort of meditation on modern marriage, modern mm-hmm. sexuality, the myth of personality. There's lots of mm-hmm. lots of ways to describe the book. How do you think about it?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned marriage, because during the time I wrote the book, I met the man who I married, uh-huh. and we got married before I finished the book. So probably marriage is a strong theme in there.
Right.
The myth of personality was something that I was maybe more consciously thinking about, because mm-hmm. I really did want to take this historical figure who had been so mythologized that I almost wasn't sure she was real.
Right.
And kind of make her more human again, kind of take the great American heroine and make her a person, kind of set her free a little bit. And that was part of the spirit behind the book.
Romantic love, sexuality in modern times, mm-hmm. the real, the imagined, the fantastic. Mm-hmm. What are you doing with those elements?
Well, I wanted the book to definitely be about, you know, sort of history and fiction, the real and the imagined. In fact, I wanted it to be about that in almost every sentence, mm-hmm. and I worked very hard. I hope to make it a book that can really be read sort of at least two ways all the time. It's funny, because some people have come up to me and said, this is such a beautiful love story, it's so romantic, what a great happy ending. And other people come up to me and say, what a tragic book, this is so sad, it's all about death. And uh-huh. and
so you've done your job.
I think that makes me very happy,
right.
because I really wanted it to be kind of a tragic fairy tale, or uh-huh. or a kind of something that was a love story with a sense of reality.
Right. Tell us, Jane, about the work of the writer. You say that in a way, I Was Amelia Earhart is about writing itself. Mm-hmm. You went to Yale, presumably what, a literature student, a history
mm-hmm.
student,
English
something
major.
Like that. Was the book work for you in that sense, or did it just sort of happen? Was it a pleasure to write? How much agony was involved?
There was agony and there was pleasure. It took me a long time to find the voice mm-hmm. for the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent 2.5 years writing it, and the first 2 years pretty much were writing a very different book, all in the third person, a more conventional historical novel.
Mm-hmm. You move back and forth between
ultimately,
the
yes.
narrative voices.
Yes.
Deliberately, I take it.
Yes. Well, all along I thought that I wanted it to be in the first person, but I never felt like I had the story sort of enough at my fingertips to do that with any kind of authenticity. So after I wrote the whole book once, all in the third person, I felt like I know the story.
Mm-hmm.
I've lived through it. I can now sit down, sort of get in character and tell it in a voice that's more natural to me. I'd written poetry in college, and mm-hmm. ultimately the voice that the book is in is more like what I was familiar with.
Did you talk to Amelia when you wrote this book? After all, Mrs. Clinton has been speaking with Eleanor Roosevelt. Roosevelt sort of indirectly figures as a character in
that's
this
true.
Book.
That's true. It's her
Did
period.
You have imaginary conversations with Amelia?
You know, not really. No seances while I was writing the book. I mean, I certainly was, I'd say I was inspired by her
right.
more than that I had uh-huh. dialogues with her.
In what way? Do you intend Amelia here secondarily to be what, a sort of mythic heroine, a feminist, taking charge of one's life? Is that too heavy-handed with the ideology?
I think that might be a little more heavy-handed than what I hope the book is, but mm-hmm. certainly I was attracted to her because she's a mythic, and she was really a tremendously charismatic person,
uh-huh.
And a visionary, and I was inspired by her because of that, and because of her commitment to, you know, ideas about women's
sure.
role in society. But also, I think the more I learned about her, the more I felt she was a very complicated person, struggling with things that any woman who is passionate about work, but, you mm-hmm. know, wanting to have a full life, struggles with. So all of that came into play.
How about the men in her life? G.P. Putnam and Fred Noonan mm-hmm. himself. Are you commenting directly, indirectly here about the war between the sexes or the happiness between the sexes? What is it?
A little bit. Also, again, from what I read, is how I developed their characters. I mean, G.P. Putnam had a reputation for being a kind of extremely ambitious. He was her business manager, and he was pretty pushy.
Is it too much to say that he was responsible for her death after a fashion?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think G.P. and Earhart and Noonan were all careless in different way, in ways that were sort of specific to their personalities.
Right.
I don't think it was, you know, any one person's doing by any means. But
But to come back to the question about the men, is there one sort of important guy in her life, according to your take on Amelia Earhart?
Well, in my book, in my version of it, it becomes Noonan.
Right.
Certainly, he's the important man in her life by the end of the book. But that's, again, that's the fairy tale part of the book. There's no, you know, evidence of that. But I think it is about relations between the sexes. That's certainly part of what the book is about.
And should we read this book as because there is a lot of romance, and I mean this in the best sense of the word, a romantic novel. Should we read this as a kind of optimistic comment on what Jane Mendelsohn is telling us about modern marriage?
I think it's again, in terms of the book being kind of having a happy ending, but also being about someone who dies. I think it's optimistic, but there's a melancholy or even tragic undertone. I want it to have the tension of both. I don't want it to be just one or the other. But I do want it to be transporting, and that's certainly something that I was hoping for.
Jane Mendelsohn is the author of I Was Amelia Earhart, a first novel published last spring by Knopf. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Audio tapes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Please write to us for a tape or send us your comments. The address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week it's program number 840. That's $10, program number 840. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, Praising Provence. Join me for a conversation featuring writer Peter Mayle and Priscilla Ferguson, a professor of French at Columbia University. They'll be here to talk about Peter Mayle's best-selling books, A Year in Provence, A Dog's Life, and his latest book, Anything Considered. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a weekly cultural affairs radio service of the National Humanities Center.